Hello, and welcome to Different Bits, A Bite of Art After the News. Today we will be speaking with Lee Montgomery. He is the founder of Neighborhood Public Radio, and he is in the studio. He will be joining us in just a minute. I wanted to start off the program with a piece by Max Neuhaus called RadioNet, and we're just going to jump right in. I'm just going to try to cue this up here. And then Lee will be with us in one moment.
Network to actually generate a piece of music from sounds, sound material, phoned in by anyone from anywhere.
National Public Radio presents Radio Net, a live nationwide composition by Max Neuhaus.
One way of explaining something, communicating it to people, is to relate it to situations which already exist, i.e. composer, conductor, performer, audience. In this case, there's really a new relationship, and those functions overlap in many ways. I'm a composer when I think up the concept. I'm a conductor, I suppose, is the closest thing I relate to when I start realizing that concept. When I'm dealing with the engineers at these stations, they are the performers. But in the final analysis, the listener himself is also the performer. So if we try to fit it into those categories, we've got several groups of people, myself, the engineers, the listeners, that edge themselves over the edge of those boxes in some way. I think the most important thing for the listener to realize is that we're making a piece of music. And all one really has to do is listen with an open mind.
NPR now invites you to become part of RadioNet. Dial any one of the following telephone numbers. Area code 213-746-7808. Area code 214-744-9010. Area code 612-291-1222. Area code 404-873-4475. Or area code 212.
Remember, of course, this is a historical document, so don't actually dial these phone numbers.
Those are the numbers of our regional centers for RadioNet in Los Angeles, Dallas, Minneapolis, Atlanta, and New York City. You may call any number during the next 2 hours, and before we start, we'll repeat those numbers again. Once you dial, your call will be answered automatically. When you hear a beep, whistle a single pitch as long as you can. Your call will be inserted onto the National Public Radio Interconnect and become part of RadioNet. Continue whistling until your call is disconnected by the automatic system.
Once the sound goes into the network, it circles the country, literally back here to Washington and out to the place where it was phoned in. Each time it passes that place where it was phoned in, it duplicates itself at a different pitch. And since this happens in fractions of seconds, we build up a layer of this one pitch. I guess in order to really clarify it, though, I have to say that the system is really picking, constantly picking, and it's not a selection for a certain period of time, but it's constantly looking at its alternatives and selecting one. So it's not like a person is picked for several minutes. It's a moment here, a moment there. It comes back to that and goes on. My main motivation is making sounds that go in people's ears and make sensations in their minds.
Call us now and participate in RadioNet. Those numbers again, area code 213-746-7808, area code 214-744-9010, area code 612-291-1222, area code 404-873-4475, or area code 212-349-8535. If you get a busy signal, hang up, wait, and try again. And dial direct. Because of the weekend rates, your performance won't cost you more than 35 cents for the first minute. And now, National Public Radio brings you Max Neuhaus's Radio Net.
You are listening to Radio Net Part 1. About this piece, Max Newhouse says, "Having made this vocally played instrument for Chicago led me to think about having callers also do the mixing and grouping for themselves. Obviously, I could not be in these five places mixing and grouping at once, so I decided to remove myself completely from that process and implement it as an autonomous electronic system. In RadioNet, the mixing was done with what could be seen as a special case of time division multiplexing. Although heard as a conventional mix of input signals, the output was actually being switched very quickly from input to input. The perceived level of an input in the mix depended on how long the output lingered on it. The technique allowed automatic mixing according to an analysis of each signal. The criterion I used here was that the highest pitch signal at any given instant won the output for that particular fraction of a second. During the broadcast, the sounds phoned into each city passed through its self-mixture and started looping. With each cross-country pass, each sound made another layer, overlapping itself at different pitches until it gradually died away. It was a beautiful Sunday afternoon, 2 hours over which 10,000 people found their way into the work and made sounds." So perhaps we will listen to a little bit more of that later. But in the meantime, Lee is here in the studio. And... want to introduce yourself, Lee?
Hey, yeah, I'm Lee Montgomery, and I guess I'm here to talk a little bit about a project that I work with called Neighborhood Public Radio. We've actually been on a bit of a break for the month of March. Our last event was the Indecency broadcast out of Artist Television Access over on Valencia and 21st in the Mission, where we basically got a bunch of people from the community to talk about indecency for about a month.
I think you're getting a little ahead of yourself.
I'm sorry.
Perhaps you want to start out by just talking a little bit about yourself and your background?
My background, personally. How far back do you want to go? I originally am a filmmaker, video maker, graduated as a filmmaker from a school out in New York, worked on commercials for a while, got sick of that, went to art school, did some net art, did a project called NorwoodFunk.com about a multiple personality system that exists on the web. It's still up if people are interested in finding out more about that.
What do you mean, a multiple personality system?
Well, basically, you know, there's multiple personality disorder, or dissociative identity disorder, as it's currently known. And so people who have multiple personalities tend to, in therapy and elsewhere, refer to themselves, I would say, as a system, because they have many different people living within them. And so... this website is the representation of a particular multiple personality system. And it interested me at the time in sort of the early days of the dot-com boom in this area, as exploring sort of how anything is represented in a mediated environment like the web, that's primarily text-based or, you know, had limited design potential, especially at that time, like in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. So, that's sort of where I came from, and then that's evolved into a few other web-based projects, some programming-based work, and eventually has led me to radio. Uh-huh. So...
Tell us, what is Neighborhood Public Radio?
It's about a year old now, Neighborhood Public Radio, and I've described it as a nomadic radio station that moves from community to community and tries to reflect the interests of both the geographical and conceptual community where it lands. And that has been art galleries for the most part, exclusively. And that probably will continue to be. So we'll go to an art gallery and we will set up a little radio station and broadcast for a limited period of time for a limited number of days during the time that we're allowed to occupy the gallery. And we've done this. The first one we did was back in January of last year at 21 Grand Gallery, and it was sort of an experiment with the form. And it started out, I should mention, as a critique of national public radio. And so we openly court the sort of the difference and the parity, I guess, on a certain level between ourselves and national public radio. The N is the big difference. Right. And so that was very central to that first event that we did.
And your logo is obviously an appropriation.
Yes, the logo is a very slight alteration of the National Public Radio logo. And that's very intentional. I mean, part of our critique of National Public Radio is very much related to the fact that they have become so centralized. In fact, if you listen to their earliest broadcasts, if you are fairly diligent, you can find the first NPR broadcast ever on the web, and it's fabulous. It's absolutely incredible. They went down into demonstrations in D.C. against the Vietnam War, talked to protesters, talked to police, and really got a sense of the violence and the passion of what was going on then. And there was, they would just let tape roll and they would let people have their voice. And that was what National Public Radio was at that time. And now it's become this sort of marketed, watered down, national, everybody sounds the same kind of mush. And the fact of the matter is that the airwaves are public property and we own them. And on top of the fact that National Public Radio has become kind of this mush, as I refer to it, mm-hmm. they've also been actively campaigning against opening up the airwaves to other voices. Mm-hmm. So in context, that means basically they're destroying any notion of public airwaves. So it seems they, as National Public Radio, have failed in their original mission. And we're sort of trying to present another possibility of what that could be.
Before we jump a little further into this mm-hmm. subject, I just wanted to give out the phone number here in the studio in case anyone listening would like to call in. That number is 415-864-1006, and we would love to hear from you. Again, it's 415-864-1006. So, continuing along that path, I think most people would trace the sort of dissolving quality of National Public Radio to sponsorship.
Yeah, well, that was a big theme.
Or underwriting.
Yeah, underwriting. Well, I would call it sponsorship. Mm-hmm. That was a big theme in the first show that we did. There were posters up with a list of all of the sponsors that were listed in a 24-hour period on NPR at the time. And they were huge posters with long lists of names. And they were sorted in various ways based on number of times mentioned, based on time of day that they were mentioned and other things. And number one in terms of number of times mentioned was Burger King. So,
really?
Yeah. So they managed to get their name out there the most on KQED specifically.
Huh. I know the one I always notice the most is Walmart.
Walmart didn't come in at that time.
Oh, really?
That was about a year ago. And I think Walmart probably is coming in a lot more lately because they're campaigning to get a new Walmart put up, I believe, in Emeryville. Uh-huh. So that's interesting. I haven't been hearing them lately, but I haven't been listening. So, but yeah, so there was a big critique of sponsorship and of the whole notion that yes, indeed, where the money comes from affects what's going to get on the air. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the constitution of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting right now, it's supposed to be a nonpartisan group with three appointees from the sitting administration and two from, so if it's Republicans, there'd be three Republicans, two Democrats. They've put Bush has put two virulent right-wing appointees, one from Voice of America and one who I believe has I forget the names at the moment, but who has actively said that people like Bill Moyers, who does one of the more interesting programs on PBS, should be fined for his lack of for his bias on PBS. And you see Tucker Carlson getting shows on PBS. It's very reflective of who's in power, and it was meant to be firewalled off from those in power, but that's obviously not the case because so you've got three Republican appointees on there, and then the two, there's supposed to be a neutral party and then another from the opposite party. The one nominee from the opposite party has been held up, and he said that the big thing that was holding up his nomination when he was interviewed by Bush's chief of staff at the time was that he didn't give the right answer to the question of would you be willing to fine people for bias on the public airwaves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everywhere we turn, whether it's corporate or government, you know, interest in public airwaves, the public airwaves are being monitored more and more and more. And that's, you know, that's why we did a show like the most recent one, the Indecency Show, because in our opinion, the indecency fines that everybody's talking about right now, the whole $500,000 per instance, is not about trying to get CBS or ABC or Howard Stern to stop creating a certain kind of content. They're just the ones to justify the particular fines that are going out. The fact of the matter is those fines are in place so that small broadcasters, like I also do a show on UC Berkeley's Calix radio, you know, if some new DJ in the middle of the day plays a song that happens to have the word, I don't know if you guys care.
We're web radio. We don't.
Oh, very good. If someone happens to play Fuck the Police and forgets to bleep the fuck, they could be charged with they could have a $500,000 fine levied against the station, which would kill the station, which would then open up that low power area for a Christian broadcaster, let's say. And that generally is what's happening. I mean, you may have heard of Brent Bozell's Parents Television Council, where they're actively monitoring stations all over the place. And actually, if you go to their website and you're looking for, you know, indecent content that was broadcast on TV, that's the place to find it because they put examples of it up on their website. But what they're trying to do is shut down small broadcasters to open up space for their own, you know, right-wing Christian broadcasters. Mm-hmm. And that tends to be where low-powered licenses are going right now.
For the listeners who might not be aware, could you just sort of explain the difference between national public radio, your local public radio station, for instance, KQED, mm-hmm. and then community radio, such as KPFA, KPFB?
Well, as I understand it, NPR is based in Washington and provides most of the programming that you hear on KQED, honestly, and on most NPR affiliates throughout the country. I have to give a hand to KLW, based here in San Francisco. You know, they don't have the power in terms of coverage that KQED does, but they do at least a slightly better job of integrating NPR into a more local kind of programming. But they are still an NPR affiliate. when somebody becomes an NPR affiliate, they have to pay for the programming from NPR. So the whole fundraising campaigns that you hear about locally, they're all about paying fees to NPR. They're not about supporting your local station.
Which is a really important point and something that's never, you know, spoken right. about on public radio if you listen to the fund.
Well, they do occasionally talk about, like, we have to pay for all this programming, but they don't make it clear that, you know, those prices keep going up and up and up, and with it, certain requirements about how the content is presented. So KQED, you know, has very little leeway. I've had arguments with people about this before who love NPR, you know, they love KQED, they love NPR, and they just can't understand why somebody would want to attack this one, you know, this one possible bastion of liberalism on the radio dial. And the fact of the matter is, they're not that liberal. And in terms of local programming, the only thing you get on KQED really is maybe the Commonwealth Club and Michael Krasny.
and what, City Arts and Lectures?
City Arts and – I think that's the
– Is that the Commonwealth
same,
Club?
It's like – it's basically like 3 hours out of the day
right.
are
local
programming. Maybe five if you include rebroadcasts. And the fact is, I can say from doing neighborhood public radio that there are far more people who are ready to share their voice and who are doing quality work. I mean, I'm going to touch back on this indecency broadcast we just did at ATA.
Which I was a part of also.
Indeed you were, and a fine part, I should add. But yeah, at ATA, we actually planned that. We had very little time to put that together. We found out that we were able to do it sometime in January. And I was really worried about it. You know, we had to fill about 8 hours of time or something, five to 8 hours of time every Saturday for three consecutive weeks. And, you know, that's a lot of time to fill if you've done any radio work. And we managed to do it. We managed to get people committed to do shows inside of a week. You know, we had the whole schedule filled within a week. And I had people from – I teach at a college out in the suburbs. I had people coming from the suburbs out to see what this crazy thing in the city was. You know, they're not used to sort of lo-fi, you know, low-power community type stuff. And they were consistently just saying, like, wow, this is really – like, I can listen to this. You know, it's not hard to listen to. This is really professional. This sounds great. So, you know, that's one of the arguments I think that comes up a lot with something like NPR, that if you open it up too much to the community, you lose a certain professionalism. And I think that's crap. But
I think just a voice in on this. Mm-hmm. What's so great about professionalism?
I'm not saying there's anything so great about professionalism. I'm just saying that's a particular.
I think NPR in particular puts out a lot of really easy to swallow pills.
Yeah,
you know, but I think that in the sort of over professionalization of a lot of their content, they make it so that listeners aren't even listening to the words anymore. They're just listening to the sound of these voices and these, you know, very soothing musical backgrounds. And
well, I think there's a difference between
between
a certain professionalism and a certain professional aesthetic. And I think what we have cultivated with NPR is something that is not it's not always easy to listen to. I mean, we had people complain about the noises that we were making at various times in our recent performance. But at the same time, it's engaging, it's interesting, it's you're not distracted by, you know, people who are fumbling with the controls for extended periods of time. And, you know, I don't know exactly. It's not something I can easily point to, but I'm just saying that there were people what's his name? Giovannoni or something. There's a particular consultant that works with NPR that has told them that if they deviate from their current sound at all, they'll lose donors. Mm. Well, I'm saying my experience with neighborhood public radio is we had all kinds of voices talking about all kinds of subject matter in all sorts of different ways, playing all kinds of music. And people from Pleasant Hill, California, who have been fed with NPR, were really impressed with, you know, we're listening, we're engaged, we're happy to be experiencing it. They weren't turned off by it.
Well, that's really great to hear.
So, so getting back to the original question way back when, National Public Radio is sort of like where most of what you hear on something like KQED comes from. Mm-hmm. Then there's KQED and KLW, which shows that there are very different ways to approach integrating with NPR, and I think that's an important point to make. I think Nicole Sawaya has done an incredible job over there of trying to work within the culture to still provide a unique community voice. Mm-hmm. And then you have something like KPFA, which is more of a democratic institution. I mean, you could go into the whole history of the Pacifica Foundation and you know where a station like that came from, but or even KLX, where I volunteer. You know, they open up the airwaves to community members based on volunteering and various procedures that are developed to allow the community to participate. But these are still licensed entities. These are still beholden to the government. These are still like this last group are the ones that are going to be most endangered. I mean, even if there's a high school station at Atherton, another one in El Cerrito. They're like all these little stations all over the place that, you know, like an El Cerrito high school station. You know, what better way to like have an after-school program for kids than to like let them come in and just talk about what's on their mind for their friends to listen to on the air or play music or whatever they want to do. But I swear to you, if some Christian broadcaster wanted that frequency, and there's one on the same frequency we've been using that's actually licensed as a translator for San Francisco called K-Love, and they've got translators all up and down California. Mm-hmm. They would love to have a little translator based in El Cerrito, right where that high school station is. And you can bet that if they wanted it bad enough, they would just monitor that broadcast for, you know, whatever time they could until they heard somebody slip up, use a bad word, report it to the FCC, $500,000 fine comes down. They're not going to be able to afford to fight it. They're going to lose their license. And then you've got another translator for K-Love. That's what these indecency fines are about. That's why, you know, that's one of many causes that Neighborhood Public Radio has felt it necessary to address.
So now maybe explain how Neighborhood Public Radio will operate or does operate and how that will be different from these other organizations.
Oh. well, how it does operate is, you know, as I said earlier, it's a nomadic station, so it's not on the air 24/7. It's not on the air, you know, it's not even on the air 24 on the days that it's up. Mm-hmm. That may change at some point. I'm not sure. We've sort of probably got to figure out what the real meat of what we're trying to do is, mm-hmm. But really what motivates us at this point is locating ourselves in communities and getting people to realize that they have a voice and that they can send that voice out, you know, into their neighborhood, and they can have their neighborhood, whether it's conceptual or geographic, they can have their neighborhood concerns, you know, addressed to a wider audience. And that has been, I think, something we've been fairly successful with. You know, in a previous incarnation, we had the Asian Women's Shelter presenting their services on the air. And while I don't pretend that we had such an audience that it totally, you know, gave them all this exposure, we do have stuff on the web that people can access that probably gave them some exposure, but it just gave them a chance to really examine themselves as a community, mm-hmm. and what their message was and look at themselves as a group. And I think, you know, that alone is a very healthy thing. It's just, you know, people talk about dance being therapeutic or singing being therapeutic. talking into a microphone or, you know, playing CDs with your friends can be very therapeutic, even if nobody's listening. So,
which may be the case right now.
It's
we won't know unless someone calls in.
What's that number?
That number again is 415-864-1006. Call and ask Leah Montgomery of Neighborhood Public Radio a question. So how about money in Neighborhood Public Radio?
Oh,
what are your plans in that respect?
That's a good question. I'm planning on applying for – there's some individual artist grants out there. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to apply as myself for some of those, and that money would be applied towards Neighborhood Public Radio. There are grants out there that we're exploring the possibility of. I am hesitant around many of the more academic grants because I worry about, you know, where the money's coming from and what kind of influence they would want to have. So artist grants, I think, are sort of where I'm looking towards now, because there's, you know, as long as it's not the NEA, I think you're pretty safe in terms of your content.
Well, and the radio station really does function as sort of a performance art piece.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, we are definitely presenting it as much art as activism, perhaps more art than activism.
I mean, unlike most radio stations, Neighborhood Public Radio does not broadcast, you know, hidden away like we are right now.
No, we're out in the open.
Tiny room in the Mission, which you will never see. They go out in public and in a way that's also exposing the technology. And, you know, it really presents people, I think, with a feeling that, oh, I could do that too. You know, anyone walking by just feels sort of immediately engaged.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the hope. And I think you asked a little bit about, you know, what it's going to be in the future. And I think there's some discussion of maybe doing more. Our last piece was at a storefront on Valencia. And I think there may be, I don't want to say too much, but there might be some opportunities to continue in that vein. And I think that's really where we thrive is when we're right on the street. And people can just turn and be like, what are they doing in there? Mm-hmm. So I think you can look for more of that to be happening in the future.
Yeah. To me, that really seemed like just a perfect venue for mm-hmm. a radio broadcast, just capturing people as they walk by on the street. People poke their head in, especially on sunny days.
Oh, yeah.
Just poke their heads in, say, you know, what's going on? How can I get involved? I mean, so many people came into ATA while you guys were broadcasting from there asking what was happening and how to get involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it was incredible. I mean, either they were asking what was happening and how to get involved, or there was also the time when we had a transvestite, Miss Ivy Drip, in the window, who invited people from the audience to come in and feel her breast. And so there was a line of people
involved,
out the door,
see?
For that. Yeah. But yeah, a lot of audience participation, and we welcome that. We encourage that. You know, we've had people who, you know, had their guests cancel at the last minute for a show they were doing, and so they invited somebody in from the street mm-hmm. to come in and talk to them. It's been, I don't know, I just, the way it's evolved over the past year has been in ways that I never would have expected, but maybe would have hoped for. And I'm just constantly surprised at where we keep going. You know, I'm... Yeah.
Yeah. And as far as taking it to the street, I did a show with some other women called See You Next Tuesday. And my favorite part of that show was our first program, where we did take the mics out on the street, you know, sunny, beautiful day in the Mission, Sunday. Saturday.
It was the Saturday before Super Bowl Sunday.
Right, right. And just, you know, talking to people on the street, it's something that you normally cannot do on the radio.
Right.
Or you have a remote reporter or something like that, which most of us don't.
And the infamous 7-second delay. But we were courting indecency that time, so there was no worries.
That's great. So on that note, actually, so what is the legality of Neighborhood Public Radio?
Hard to say, really. I mean... you could get into the whole legality of low power broadcasting in general. And, you know, it's interesting to kind of look at what's going on with San Francisco Liberation Radio right
now. So step back for a second. Mm-hmm. Just briefly describe the technology you're using. I mean, how low is your low power, that kind of thing?
We have an 80-watt transmitter with a Comet antenna. I mean, what we've been doing is using that from, locations very close to the gallery. The whole unit probably all told cost, between $300 and $500 total, which when you've got a group of people, that doesn't need to be a big problem. The first broadcast we did was with a six watt transmitter. It was great. It was a 6-watt transmitter with a dipole antenna mounted outside of 21 Grand Gallery. And we kept saying Neighborhood Public Radio broadcasting between Telegraph and Broadway from 14th to MacArthur. That was about it. But that was all that we needed. People knew who were coming to the events that they could tune in and they'd hear it as they came in and as they went away. And, there were these two roommates, these two guys that came by the last day at the very end and informed us that they'd been listening the entire time that we'd been, the entire 5-day run from their house a few blocks away. That was our first time out. So 6 watts and we were able to reach people that way. That particular transmitter, John, who's one of the collaborators on this project, had gotten by trading a digital camera to someone that he'd met through Craigslist for the transmitter. And admittedly, I think the transmitter was a little bit damaged. We had to take it to Free Radio Berkeley, and I think it cost like $20 to get it fixed up, and it worked like a charm. So this isn't hard stuff to do. You definitely can't be afraid of maybe having to touch a soldering iron every now and then, but
no fear of that here.
Yeah. So
6 watts, that sounds legal.
No.
Not even legal at 6 watts.
No. Well, it's funny. I teach at I don't know if I should be saying this. I don't know where this is going, but I will anyway. I teach at a community college up in Pleasant Hill, California, and I'm on a technology committee there. And they were talking about, I guess there's a school up in Napa where they have these little transmitters on the campus that really only broadcast on the campus. To give people directions to places so they can tune into their radio when they get on campus. And I think that is technically legal, even though they're probably working with a 1 to 6 watt transmitter of some sort, because it only covers within a private, within private land. So that's at least a gray area in that regard. In fact, there's a piece in the Guggenheim right now where, I wish I could remember the artist's name, is broadcasting a low-power TV in New York City, but the signal is restricted to inside the Guggenheim Gallery,
The size of the transmitter, or is there other?
There are various ways you can limit your signal. I'm not sure exactly how he's doing it, but anyway, so that I just read about that the other day in the New York Times. But your question was 6 watts sounds legal. 1 watt is illegal. There was a show recently at the Walker Arts Center where they were teaching people to construct legal transmitters that they could use to sort of relay a signal. Mm. And those were under 1 watt. I forget exactly what the wattage was on that, but 1 watt is illegal.
Wow.
But what I was going to say about where I work, they had heard about this place in Napa with their transmitters, and they wanted to do the same thing. And they had heard I did this radio stuff, and they were asking me about it. And I was like, I'd be happy to build you a transmitter. And That's all I said.
Uh-huh. So are you going to do a little workshop?
We may do workshops at some point. Our next big gig, and I'm probably be sending an email out about this in the next couple of days. We're going to Chicago for Version Fest in the last week of April, and we're going to do a workshop and sort of a historical presentation, and we'll operate Neighborhood Public Radio for a week out of a gallery space in Chicago for Version Fest, which is at versionfest.org.
So, and what is Version Fest?
It's a media activism and art event that sort of takes place all over Chicago. They've got multiple gallery spaces, and they basically took a call for artists who might be interested in I guess we got a phone call, huh?
Men Radio.
Wrong number. Oh, okay. Wrong number. Anyway, so they had an open call on the web for people who wanted to do sort of responses to the media climate in the United States based at the festival in Chicago. And we submitted that we'd like to be the radio station for Version Fest, and they were very excited about it and are going to help us set something up. And I think we're probably going to bring a low-power TV unit as well. And,
Well, that sounds exciting. So will we be able to tune into your new community?
Hard to say at this point. It depends on what technology we can get going. We're hoping to set up a new, or at least we have friends who are hoping to set up a new transmitter, that should be able to cover Oakland and San Francisco. And, you know, we're going to start experimenting with other ways of you know, maybe having a static transmitter, but still be moving from place to place so that we can expose more people to what's going on. Mm-hmm. So if we get that up and running and we still have enough equipment to take to Chicago, we may do a simultaneous kind of broadcast. Okay. We'll see what happens.
So just to jump back to the legal issue for a moment. So you broadcast illegally, and these are, you know, very public advertised events. Do you worry about consequences of this at all, or what are those possible consequences?
Honestly, I prefer not to talk about that too much because I certainly don't want to challenge anyone any more than we already are. You know, I think the piece speaks for itself. I don't have any fear of us being nabbed, as it were. I mean, the way it works is they generally will give you a warning before they actually come in and do anything. They don't arrest people. Because if they arrested you, then they'd have to go to a jury trial, and the FCC is pretty confident, or not confident, as you want to describe it. They're pretty confident that if they took an individual and put him on the stand in a jury trial for broadcasting, that probably the jury would rule that their enforcement of their policies around restrictions around bandwidth would probably be overturned, and then they wouldn't be able to harass anybody. So what they do instead is they use maritime law to seize people's equipment. And so they claim that you're doing something illegal without ever actually charging you with a crime.
Maritime law?
Yeah, maritime law that allows them to board a ship that they suspect might be committing some illegal activities, so they can board a house, I guess.
A ship to be taken loosely.
Yes. And they'll take your equipment. But they do give you warnings, and we, warnings, we like warnings.
Warnings will be heeded.
I don't know about that, but, you know, we get warnings. We'll read them and be warned.
Move on. I mean, the beauty of your station, of course, is that you, I mean, generally the problem with pirate stations is having to move the transmitter, but for you guys, that's sort of built into the concept. So
yeah,
it's not so much of an issue.
I mean, yeah, I mean, that's the other part of it, I guess, is, you know, we only do it for a few hours a day. Mm-hmm. We have yet to do a full week of broadcasts anywhere. You know, I think it's more, in many ways, it's more, it's art because it is in many ways more of a gesture in solidarity with people who are doing more consistent and more honestly dangerous in terms of the legal ramifications work. And you know, I don't have any hesitation around that. That seems to me the way to do it for what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, you know, many, many thousands of flowers can bloom from that.
So what's so important about the airwaves? Why not just move on to the internet? Why are the airwaves even worth fighting for at this point?
Because computers are still expensive. You know, people have radios. You know, one of the things that Free Radio Berkeley is doing now that's most impressive and that I respect beyond belief is helping, you know, small radical struggles in, you know, other countries in Central America and Brazil. You know, there's been work down in South Africa during the apartheid struggle. It's, you know, people have radios, and you know, you can't like be sitting on your porch with your computer listening to streaming internet broadcasts, especially if you're in a poor neighborhood. You're not likely to be doing that. But you know, you can get your $5 radio from the thrift store and sit on the porch with your friends, and you know, a lot of people can listen to that one radio. And that, you know, what's so important about the airwaves? Why in the world does Clear Channel own every single radio station out there? There's something important about the airwaves if it's still valuable, you know, to get a radio station of your own that's legal, that covers any kind of territory, especially in an urban market, you're talking millions of dollars. That's what's important about the airwaves. It's like, if it's worth $10 million to these corporations, it's worth $10 million to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm doing it for $300 to $500. So.
Do you want to speak a little bit more about that, about the Clear Channel sort of takeover?
I don't know. I don't know what to say that hasn't already been said. You know, Clear Channel and Infinity own most of the radio stations that people can listen to in the Bay Area. And the Bay Area has one of the more diverse radio markets in the United States. Clear Channel, you know, was involved in staging pro-war rallies, was involved in censoring any music that could possibly be interpreted as anti-war when Bush was leading up to the most recent attacks on Iraq. They're evil. I mean, they own billboards. They own radio. They are a propaganda arm of the U.S. government. I don't know any clearer way to say it. Mm-hmm. And they should be stopped. They
will be stopped.
Let's hope. And that's certainly something we're interested in. But I think what we focus on is, I mean, Clear Channel, that seems like such an obvious problem and struggle, and people should be aware of that, and I think people are aware of that. I think what we're interested in doing with Neighborhood Public Radio is pointing to the fact that that one little area that you think is so nice is also troubled, mm-hmm. and is also a problem, and also has done very much its fair share to support, you know, the most evil tendencies in our government.
Right, meaning National Public Radio.
National, right. The other NPR,
right.
the one that's not us.
Yeah, I'm earlier in the show I did pull up the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting website here. I mean, their assessment of National Public Radio was only, you know, like a tiny notch above, you know, even looking at like Fox News. I mean, obviously Fox right. News was significantly worse, but as far as comparing National Public Radio to mainstream radio stations, their coverage of minorities, women, you know, looking at who they interview as guests, as, you know, experts in this mm-hmm. kind of thing, really they're not doing very much better at all.
They're labeled liberal by the right, but that's just so that they then have to tell, you know, prove to the right how liberal they're not. You know, the fact of the matter is they've got Republicans outnumbering Democrats largely on the airwaves. Not that there's that much difference between the two, but, you know, it's a signal of some sort. If you go on our website, conceptualart.org/NPR, there's an article that I wrote back around Christmas about how Tavis Smiley decided not to accept a contract renewal from NPR. He did the Tavis Smiley show as part of NPR, and he said it was because there wasn't enough support for minority broadcasting on NPR. And so he left. At that same, you know, right in that same week that that announcement was made, Morning Edition had rebroadcast David Sedaris' story about being an elf at Macy's during Christmas time. And there's one scene in it where he talks about the male elves all flirting with each other. I don't even think he uses the words gay or homosexual anywhere in actually, I think he does refer to one of the elves as gay. But anyway, they censored that line of his essay for their Christmas broadcast for the first time in 10 years. They've been running it for 10 years. Suddenly this year they decided they couldn't keep that sentence in. Now tell me that NPR is serving the public interest when for 10 years there was no problem. Suddenly this year there's a problem with that one sentence. I think they're being influenced unduly by some forces. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure where to take that.
I mean, well, yeah, I mean, I could go on and on about how they, you know, whine about how they, you know, those emails about how NPR is about to lose its funding.
Right. I mean, it's sort of the gist of it. The sort of important point of that is that listenership, you know, reflects who is being represented on programming. So if you don't have minorities and you don't have women, you know, that turns NPR into white male radio, basically. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you guys at Neighborhood Public Radio are at least making a step, you know, a much greater step than most radio stations in, you know, effectively getting out your word and showing people that they can come in local communities, you know, more than I've seen. You know, we've sort of been addressing issues of accessibility and stuff like this quite a bit on this program. I don't know if you would want to comment on that. We sort of spoke about it earlier.
I'm not sure exactly where you're going with that, but I would say in terms of like the diversity of our programming or in terms of the community participation in what we're doing, I think everybody makes a good faith effort, you know, who's genuinely interested in providing a voice for the community. I think everybody finds themselves in different situations as far as that goes. As far as for us, I think we have the benefit of doing short-term broadcasts. And so it's much easier to get somebody to say, oh yeah, I can do 3 weekends or I can do, you know, 6 shows. If we were trying to recruit people to do this on an ongoing basis, it might be a little bit harder.
That's very similar to the indie media model of news in mm-hmm. general, not so much on enemy combatant radio, but in terms of like Fault Lines, the newspaper and the website. Indie media in general uses, you know, the model of community volunteering mm-hmm. the news themselves.
Right. And that's certainly, you know, as much as possible, our interest is to contact a group and say, you know, do you want to produce a radio show? And if we can not even have to touch the equipment, all the better. Mm-hmm. You know, the less our voices are heard. I mean, we like to do our own shows too. Everybody loves to hear themselves talk, but we definitely, you know, it would be very easy for us to set up a situation where we invited community groups in and we interviewed them. And I think for as long as I've been working with media, even when I was doing, you know, sort of avant-garde filmmaking, it's been my concern, you know, to be this, you know, this person providing something to people. Mm-hmm. And I think the more you can let people do it themselves, the more it becomes theirs. And that's really what we want it to be.
And, you know, in doing that, you're enabling people, you know, you're showing them how to use the technology and enabling them to use this technology in the future on their own. In a closing note, would you like to let our listeners know how they can get involved?
Probably the best way would be to send an email to npr@conceptualart.org. And we will take all requests very, very seriously. We're actually looking at expanding our operations right now, and may, as I was maybe alluded to a little bit earlier, we may have a permanent home before too long, at which point we will go into a full-on recruitment drive for additional volunteers. But if you want to do a radio show in one of our future broadcasts, definitely send an email, npr@conceptualart.org.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for joining us, Lee.
Thank you.
Be in touch, and we will look forward to hearing more about your possibly permanent home.
Yes.
On that note, I am going to leave you guys tonight with a little bit more of that Max Neuhaus RadioNet piece, which has been playing the whole time, actually. And let's see. Next week, we will be speaking with Tad Hirsch. He works at the Media Lab and does a lot of really interesting work, including he worked on the Text Mob project, and he does these pieces where, you know, you look for the path of least surveillance through a city, that kind of thing. So Tad will be joining us on the phone next week, so tune in then. And that's it for now. Have a good night.